Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the New Plaza Cinema Podcast, the podcast made by cinephiles for cinephiles. For this episode, we will be diving right into the cinematic lore, intense casting process, and wild production stories behind one of the most iconic film musicals of all time, the original West Side Story, with seasoned Turner Classic Movies host and author Richard Barrios. We hope you enjoy today's episode.
Hello, everybody. I am Norma Levy, New Plaza Cinema's president. We're a nonprofit devoted to film lovers. Gary Palmucci, our curator, has chosen for today's talkback the masterful Academy Award-winning 1961 film, West Side Story. Gary will be joined by our wonderful film historian, Max Alvarez, and two other special guests, including filmmaker Dan Cahill and Richard Barrios, author of the recently published book entitled West Side Story, The Jets, the Sharks, and the Making of a Classic. We're so glad to have you join us. And please, Gary, begin.
Well, thank you, Norma. Welcome, everyone. Now, trailers for classic films can often be slapdash pieces of work, but our beloved United Artists evidently took some care with this one.
They did, and I remember seeing this trailer at a calendar house in the 1970s. Of course, we serious West Side people know that it's filmed in Panavision 70, as in 70 millimeter, which
You read my mind. I'd say only four or five dozen Hollywood films were actually shot with 70 millimeter cameras. Does that sound right?
You mean Hollywood musicals?
Or just big Hollywood pictures in general?
I would say it went over the dozen mark. I mean, you did have the epics like in the Ben-Hur and Lawrence of Arabia range. When it came to musicals, there were not many. There was, of course, West Side Story, and there was The Sound of Music and Star, and just a couple of others. But
the ill-fated Porgy and Bess by Otto Preminger.
And Porgy and Bess as well. I don't know about you, Gary, but for me, for decades, I have been amassing so many conspiracy theories about this film. Who directed what? Who was fired? Who was replaced? Who dubbed whom? And I got so frustrated not knowing how to get the answers. And fortunately, we have a guest today who's going to help us answer those questions. So
I've always wondered that, too. Where this is only one of two Oscar winners for Best Picture that has a dual director credit. Maybe we'll see who can come up with the other one on our comments line here. But Jerome Robbins gets co-directing credit, and we're told that he accepted the Oscar on Oscar night, but there was a lot of switchblades and ash cans going on, I think, in between all that.
It's an amazing story, and we were so honored today to have Richard Barrios with us today. Richard Barrios is the author of this amazing book that Norma mentioned, West Side Story, The Jets, the Sharks, and the Making of a Classic. It's published by Turner Classic Movies. And it is the equivalent of getting access to some classified government files. There are so many mysteries that are solved in this book about the production of the movie. And I have 350 or close to 1,000 questions for Richard. Gary's going to have to keep me in line. And of course, we have to get Dan to chime in as well. Richard Barrios is the author of the award-winning A Song in the Dark, The Birth of the Musical Film. He also wrote Screened Out, Playing Gay in Hollywood, From Edison to Stonewall, Dangerous Rhythm, Why Movie Musicals Matter, and Turner Classic Movies Must-See Musicals. He's presented films at the Smithsonian Institution and Film Forum here in New York. He served as a co-host on Turner Classic Movies. He's appeared in documentary films, and he's contributed to audio commentaries to numerous DVD and Blu-ray releases. Needless to say, it's a great honor to have with us Richard Barrios. Richard, welcome to New Plaza Cinema.
Thank you. It is an immense pleasure to be here. I've so enjoyed meeting you all, and I'm very, very glad to be here. So thank you for having me.
Richard, when you were writing this amazing book, which, by the way, people can purchase through Barnes & Noble and that other big online company, or you can ask your local bookstore to order it. When you were researching this book, did you find yourself just calling out Eureka throughout your research project as you were going through paperwork? And how did you find out some of the secrets to the making of the film?
Well, for me, a lot of it had to do with taking a trip. I live in suburban Philadelphia on the New Jersey side, and taking a trip out for a few days to Los Angeles and going to the University of Southern California, USC, which has an amazing cinema collection. And several of the studios have left pretty much all their papers and scripts, and individuals have as well. And one of those individuals very happily was the redoubtable Robert Wise, who was a co-producer and co-director of West Side Story, and of course, many other outstanding films as well. And very happily, Mr. Wise saved pretty much close to everything. And there were boxes of materials on West Side Story, and I was able to go through just about everything he had there. And so it really gave me a kind of large scale sense of what it was like putting this movie together. And most especially, and this was that sort of happy revelation for me, I mean, you know, West Side Story has been around now for 60 years, and it's fair to say, I think we've taken it for granted because it's been with us, but the care and deliberation and thought, as well as artistry that went into making it, it was not at its time an assembly line musical. For one thing, it wasn't made at a big studio. The big studios were still operational in 1960 when it was shot, but this was an independent production, and it was almost like artisans putting together this very small, hand-tooled, meticulously wrought object, and they put that much thought and craft and skill and love into it. And Mr. Wise's papers really made this all very, very clear to me. And so after that happened, I started seeing the movie through newer eyes. And then one of the aspects of that that I found really, really eye-opening, so much so that I devoted a whole chapter to it in the book, was the casting process for this movie. You know, they did not know on day one they were going to put Natalie Wood in and Rita Moreno and a lot of the others. They went through, and Wise in particular, went through this long and arduous process. And as I've already noted in a couple of interviews, just about the only people that were not considered for roles in West Side Story were Margaret Hamilton and Vincent Price. Just about everyone else was on the table. Wise spoke to and tested a lot of people. And, you know, some of them make you scratch your head a bit. Frankie Avalon. But hey, they really were after getting the best possible talent together in front of the camera as well as behind the camera.
Well, the section on the casting is amazing. It is astonishing the names that were being considered. I mean, if I'm not mistaken, Robert Redford came up as he was starting out. And there was also talk of even Warren Beatty. Is that correct, as Tony?
And Warren Beatty had actually been considered for the original Broadway production. We found Mr. Bernstein had listened to him sing when they were, you know, putting the cast together for the original show. And then Beatty did it. And it was interesting. They were still thinking about Warren Beatty for Tony. And they went back and looked at some clips from the movie Splendor in the Grass, which was still in production when they were planning West Side Story. And their eyes went from Beatty to Natalie Wood. And so Beatty ended up not being cast in the movie, but of course Natalie Wood did. So, but he was in the running for a while. And so, you know, Redford was very, very seriously under consideration. And if you have seen a lot of episodes of series television from the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, you have seen a lot of the people being considered for Tony and Maria and Riff and Anita and Bernardo, people like Doug McClure, who was a serious candidate for the role of Tony. And over you'll see these familiar names from television, especially. Mary Tyler Moore was interviewed before she even had the Tyler in her name. It was that early on. So it was well before the Dick Van Dyke Show and all. Wise spoke to her but thought that she read too mature to play Maria, even though she was the same age as Natalie Wood, but just read more mature on screen. And over, all these people they spoke to. And of course, West Side Story is, as we all know, a musical. And what was very striking to me was the fact that singing was not necessarily a primary consideration in the casting of this movie. It was thought of, well, if they can sing, it's nice, but it's not necessarily vital, because the associate producer, Saul Chaplin, had already been an old hand at fitting on-screen faces with off-screen voices who were not, you know, the same people. And it had already been pretty much decided that they would go very, very heavily on the dubbing. And so they would have liked maybe for one or two of the actors to have been able to do their own singing, but it was never a serious primary consideration in the film. And of course, that is one of the things that sometimes people wonder about with the original film, is why they didn't do it. And it's because it wasn't as crucial to them as we might have thought.
Well, we know, Richard, about Natalie Wood, but now you seem to be suggesting it was quite a bit more dubbing than I think many of us are under the impression of other key players. Is that right?
Oh, yeah. Jimmy Bryant, the off-screen singer, dubbed Richard Beamer all the way through. Beamer would have liked to have tried to do his own singing, but he wasn't even given the option. Natalie did record her songs and shot her song numbers using her own voice for playback, even though behind the scenes, they were not really seriously thinking that it was going to be released with her voice. Rita Moreno was dubbed in her version of A Boy Like That.
A boy like that would kill your brother. Forget that boy and find another one of your own.
It was an off-screen singer named Betty Wand. Although Rita does her own singing in most of the Rumble scene and in America.
Puerto Rico, my heart's devotion.
It is Rita's voice. And Russ Tamblyn does his own singing in G. Officer Krupke.
With all their marijuana, they won't give me a puff. They didn't want to have me, but somehow I was had. Please.
But earlier on in his version of Jet Song, he recorded it, and then Saul Chaplin decided near the last minute that he preferred having another singer. So another cast member, one of the Jets, who could do a good Russ Tamblyn imitation, actually was hired to do his singing.
Jet, you're a jet, all the way from your first cigarette to your last dying day.
And you listen to the two recordings side by side, they're very similar. But Mr. Tamblyn was understandably pretty irked about that. And Natalie Wood was livid. She was furious that they had told her originally that she would be singing, or had implied that she'd be singing, and had let her record the songs, and then it was taken away from her.
But it is unusual. We have two directors, Robert Wise and Jerome Robbins, and it's generally assumed, or I mean, by someone who didn't know the history, that the two were sitting side by side patiently throughout the entire production, making the decisions. And apparently, you're laughing, so apparently that was not the case.
They would have loved for it to have been so, but life does not always follow expectations. And they knew the main producer, Walter Mirisch, had seen the show on Broadway, and he knew immediately that Jerome Robbins had to be part of the movie, because the original show reflected Jerome Robbins's vision more than it did any other single person's. He was West Side Story, essentially. So they knew he had to be part of the movie, but he had virtually no screen experience. The only film that he had really worked on in any capacity was he had done the dances for The King and I in 1956. So you couldn't give him the entire movie. So they approached Robert Wise, who had virtually no musical film experience at all. He had worked on a film with a nightclub setting that had songs in it, but otherwise, he did almost every other genre known, including science fiction and film noir and Westerns and many, many, many other things, but had never done a musical. So they figured that in ways that would benefit the film, that Wise, with his filmmaking expertise, and Robbins, with his vision and skill in choreography and musical considerations, would be a good balance and complement. And okay, in some ways it was, but there were factors that made it more difficult than they would have liked, which is why Mr. Robbins more or less did not make it to the end of the shoot.
Well, we're going to get back to that because that's so important about the scenes that Robbins worked on. So, Richard, things are going well in the beginning with Robbins and Wise working together. I presume from your book, a lot of this was the New York location filming where Robbins was, his influence was most greatly felt. Is that correct?
I would say that. And those were the first scenes to be shot in the film. They front loaded the location work. So before then, there had been months of preparation in California where with Robbins working with the dancers and especially, and Wise was one of the producers of the film. So he was seeing to a lot of other things, including, as Dan will talk about, the look of the film, because he was working a lot with the art director, Boris Levin. So they had both kind of had their own bailiwicks and would converse. But then when you get to New York and the very beginning of the filming, particularly those wonderful first minutes of the film that are shot on the streets of what was still New York in 1960, and a lot of it does not exist anymore, that was the first time they actually had the tandem directorial arrangement. And that ended up from very, very early on, which it was clear from pretty early on, did not always mesh well.
Terrific. We will get back to that. And Dan, we'd love to hear more of your thoughts on the visual look.
One thing that's clear is that both directors and producers, everybody had a mission here to not remind anyone that this began on a stage. There are very few shots in this movie that mimic the proscenium.
Robert Wise, sometimes with the screenwriter Ernest Lehman, had taken several trips late in 1959, early in 1960 to New York to scout locations. It was Robert Wise's notion that the film should use actual locations, which was not Jerome Robbins's preference. He would have preferred to have shot the whole thing in the studio. So this did end up being a compromise because Wise certainly had his way with the famous opening of the film, which was all shot on location in Manhattan, and then it goes to the studio for almost all the rest of the film. But Wise scouted a lot in the city to find what he considered to be photogenic sites. And of course, as is well known, in the movie, it appears that the playground and the street are right adjacent to each other. But in reality, they were 4 miles apart. The playground is on the Upper East Side, and it's still there, and it's relatively recognizable. Whereas the street is completely gone. Even the street itself is obliterated for the Lincoln Towers complex that was put there. But when the street was still there, because they filmed right before the buildings got knocked down, they did a lot of redecorating, let's call it, of the streets to shoot those early scenes. And a lot of things got sort of transformed and painted and redecorated to create what we see now in the film.
You mentioned, Richard, one particular spot, which is kind of a pilgrimage for West Side Story fans. Could you pinpoint where that is for us?
You mean the playground on the east side? That is, is it 101st Street?
It's East 110th.
Okay, yes. And it's now called Tito Puente Way or something. Like, there's part of it that's named after a famous person. I know that. But I did go there, and there's been some rebuilding and some changes in the last 60 plus years. But when you're there, you can feel the vibe, and there's enough of it that's recognizable that it's kind of a, If you love West Side Story, it's a sacred spot.
East 110, and what's the avenue, the cross avenue?
I think it's between 1st and 2nd Avenues, I think. It's right in the middle of the block.
Great, thank you.
You'd think by now they'd make it a historic landmark, but that is a very powerful section of your book. That's a very, it's very powerful in your book when you talk about the whole Lincoln Square, San Juan Hill area, and all the redevelopment nightmare that was going on in the slum clearance. Very powerful stuff, and how Wise was catching certain blocks literally at the last moment of their existence.
And actually had to pay the contractors sort of under the table to go elsewhere with the wrecking balls so that they could shoot the streets that they wanted to use for the film, because otherwise they would have been knocked down a little bit earlier. And so they were able to pay money to keep them long enough to film. And some of the buildings that they filmed in front of were only the fronts. The backs were already gone. And they had to be very, very careful of what they shot to make it look like it was still, you know, somewhat of an active community, whereas it was, by then it had already been a ghost town, and the people had who were living there had already been, you know, forced to leave.
And it's pretty much a given that all the musical numbers, with the exception of the gym dance sequence, were supervised in part by Jerome Robbins. Is that correct?
The major dance numbers, yes. And he choreographed the gym dance number, but that started being shot basically the day after he was discharged. So that was Wise. And if you really look at the gym dance with a very acute critical eye, you can see that cinematically, it may not have the final degree of polish that some of the other sequences do, like the prologue or Cool. In particular, that even though Wise was on the set, Robbins really had pretty much total dominion over these numbers. And of course, it was Robbins's incredible perfectionism that in some ways sort of sealed his fate to be discharged from the film, because he was never so satisfied that he didn't want to go back and reshoot and do take after take after take, which is why we have the brilliance that we have on film, but it also came at a very, very high financial cost that the producers were very, very aware of. And so they basically decided that the things that Robbins had to be in charge of, once he got those done, that Wise would be able to manage the rest of it. And there's no verification of this at all, but you wonder if even going in, there might have been some thought, because the way the shooting, the schedule had been arranged was that the musical numbers and the things that Robbins would have had the most dominion over were earlier in the shoot, and the more non-musical sequences were primarily what came later on. So you wonder if someone thought, well, if he's trouble, then we can cut him and still be able to do the movie. And I don't wish to be cynical about it, but come on, it's Hollywood we're talking.
It's Hollywood. Be as cynical as you want. You're probably going to be right on target. So, Richard, obviously it's a given. We all know it's the best kept, or it's the worst kept secret that Marnie Nixon dubbed Natalie Wood's vocals. And as you indicated, Natalie Wood was a little surprised when this happened. You, as I understand it, actually heard some of the original recordings of Natalie Wood singing her songs. Can you share your thoughts on that? What was that like?
At one point in her career, Natalie Wood did consider having a singing career. She had worked on a movie with Sinatra, and they got along very, very well. And she did a TV special with him and sang with it. And so she sort of fancied herself, you know, a possible singer. And she was very, very eager to do the songs for Maria herself. And she did not have a lot of lead time on the film to prepare either the singing or the dancing. She had a really, really concentrated block of time to work on all this, but she did work with a vocal coach and did record all the numbers and shot them to her own playbacks, her own recordings. Meanwhile, while she was in the recording studio doing that, Marnie Nixon was physically present for a lot of that, and Natalie kind of knew who she was, and they told her that Marnie would be there to maybe sweeten some of the recordings if a note needed to be here or there put in or something like that, which Marnie had done in previous films already.
On this Blu-ray edition of the movie, there is a disc of extra features, and you can get to see the full song, I Feel Pretty, the film of it, resynced with Natalie Wood's original voice.
Yes.
And you'll notice a difference.
Oh, so pretty, I feel pretty and witty and gay, and I pity any.
I'm not saying she's terrible, but it's a little thinner voice than Marnie Nixon's. Just putting that out there.
Yeah. One thing I mentioned in the book would be at this remove 60 years later, there would be no question that someone as famous as Natalie Wood would have had her own vocals used and electronically manipulated to give them a little more body. And she did not have an unpleasant voice. She actually got to sing with her own voice shortly after West Side Story in the film of Gypsy, where depending which source, it's either all of it is her singing or most of it is her singing. And she was very glad about that, because when she was told near the end of shooting that her vocals would not be used for Maria, she was really, really, really angry. And she had already been incensed and hurt by the firing of Jerome Robbins, with whom she had bonded. And she liked Robbins very much and was not particularly taken with Robert Wise. So she had that. And then when it came to the singing and she found out that they were going to use Marnie Nixon's vocals and not hers, she was livid. And that is why in later years, she would never tend to talk about West Side Story with any great fondness, because for her, it represented some kind of failure or letdown. And, you know, yeah, it was the most financially successful film of her career, but she saw it as, you know, that they had thought she wasn't good enough. And that really, really bothered her.
Natalie Wood does her own singing in Gypsy, and even inside Daisy Clover, she does some of her own vocals in that picture. There's controversy about Wood's casting, the wavering Spanish accent.
Mother will wake up.
Just for a minute.
A minute is not enough.
For an hour, then.
I cannot.
Then forever.
And so on. But that last scene at the very end in the playground, I feel she makes up, and I presume with Robert Wise's assist power behind the camera, whatever deficiencies there were beforehand.
You all killed him, and my brother, and Riff. Not with bullets and guns, with hate. Well, I can kill too.
It's so powerful, her appearance in that last scene, that it actually overshadows the new version. And I think that Rachel Zegler is outstanding as Maria in the new version. She's fantastic. But there's a devastating emotional impact that you have in the original that I didn't feel at the end of the new one. Just, I don't think Natalie Wood had a lot to do with that. That's just my thoughts.
I agree with that completely. The 61 film has a couple of added lines that they gave Natalie Wood that are not in the newer version right in that scene. And Wood really delivers it. And with I Can Kill Too, pull the trigger. I mean, she really, really gets to the power of it. My personal thought is that Natalie Wood was an uneven performer when you got her when she was really, really good. She really, really connected with a role and with the audience. And you see it off and on in West Side Story. And as you said, Max, for many people, the wavering nature of the accent is an issue. And some of that comes with the short amount of lead time that she had working on the role, because she was the last major actor to be cast in the film. And they had already started the location shoot in New York before she was even signed for it. So she had a very, very short lead time to work on that, to work on the dancing, to work on the singing. That's a lot for one person. And Rita Moreno and someone we just lost, Yvonne Wilder, also known as Yvonne Othon, who plays one of the shark girlfriends, both worked on her to some extent on the accent. But there's a reason why a lot of people don't see it as being really authentic. I think that's valid.
This is really wonderful. And of course, be sure to buy Richard's book on West Side Story. It's a great stocking filler for the holidays.
Thank you. Happy holidays.
Thank you.
Merry, merry, happy, happy, everyone. Yes.
Thanks, everyone.
This discussion was facilitated by film curator Gary Palmucci, film historian Max Alvarez, and cinematography expert Dan Cahill. Also, special thanks to Norma Levy, Marianne Tesler, Sean Moore, and Polly Rittenberg for making the production of this podcast possible. This podcast was directed, produced, edited, and narrated by Hannah Kavanaugh. Yours truly. Thank you so much for tuning in, everyone, and we hope you have a wonderful holiday season. Take care.